This is episode 9 of season X of the GNU World Order. We have a fortune of the show. It's a fairly long one, but it's manageable. We can do it. The bone-chilling scream split the warm summer night into the first half being before the scream, when it was fairly balmy and calm and pleasant. The second half still balmy and quite pleasant for those who hadn't heard the scream at all, but not calm or balmy, or even very nice for those who did hear the scream, discounting the little period of time during the actual scream itself, when your ears might have been hearing it, but your brain wasn't reacting yet to let you know. And that is the winning sentence of the 1986 Bulwer Lytton Bad Fiction Contest. So, today we're going to talk about, we'll have an Emacs tip of the show, obviously. We're going to talk about MariaDB, which is the drop-in replacement for MySQL. And we'll also talk about file managers for the noobs out there. And we'll probably do a little bit of compiling code as well. So let's just start out with the Emacs tip, because that's kind of an easy one to tackle. I just want to talk about split screen. It's a really quick tip. Previously, we have talked about splitting windows in Emacs. Control X 3 splits it vertically. Control X 2 splits it horizontally. And of course, Control X 0 makes the current buffer go. The current window. They call these windows in Emacs. The area that you split is a window, not a buffer. They contain buffers, but that's a window or a pane, I guess. So Control X 0 makes that go away. Control X 1 makes the current one stay and the other one go away. Essentially, is how you can think of it. So that's those are the splitting commands. What's kind of nice is the readjustment of all of these things. So I'm going to go ahead and open up just kind of some sample content in here, just so that we have something to look at other than the scratch buffer. Got a dir-ed window here. We've got a shell window in the bottom. And then we've got just a random text file over on the right. So one cool thing is shrinking a buffer. Well, let's start with enlarging a buffer, I guess. So here we are in the dir-ed, and if we want to make it larger, we could say Control X caret, which is the symbol above the number 6 on the British and American keyboards, as far as I know. Or is this a British keyboard? This is an American keyboard, I guess. Well, anyway, it's above the 6, this little pointy symbol. That guy right there, caret. So that symbol, Control X, that symbol, the caret symbol, makes the current buffer taller. Now, don't think that means it raises it upward necessarily, because if the window that you're in is on the top and there's a window below it or a pane below it, then you're moving your split down on your screen. So it's just, think of it as it's increasing the height of your current panel. Likewise, you can increase the width with Control X curly bracket. And that one, as far as I know, and there might be an equivalent for the height one. I don't know it if there is. But that one you do actually, you can go in two different directions. I tend not to. I tend to just use the curly brace that points to the right. And again, just kind of, I always think of that's increasing my current buffer, my current panel, in this case in the width direction. So if I'm in a different one, then I still hit Control X. And even though that bracket is pointing to the right, it's still making it wider. And my screen split is actually moving left towards the left of my monitor. But, yeah, that's just kind of, I don't really worry about dragging it one way or the other. I just activate the panel that I want to increase, and I use either the curly brace or the caret to increase it in either the width or the height, respectively. So there you go. Now, that's a lot of click, 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 click. You have to Control X and then bracket and Control X and then shift, you know, whatever. That's a lot of keys, so it's kind of nice that you can hit Control U, which is the universal argument command, and let's say we're going to do 8 of Control X and then curly brace, and that repeats the curly brace action 8 times. So I'll do that again. So Control U, and now it's waiting for a universal argument. So I'm going to say, let's say 12, and now it's going to do something for 12 times, and that is Control X and curly brace, and you can kind of see that my screen split moves fairly dramatically over to the right to make this buffer wider. So that's a good thing to know about, is the Control U command. So I'm going to say Control U and then the number 9, and then Control X and then Shift 6, and that increases the height of this panel and minimizes the one below it. Another kind of related cool trick is Control X and then the minus key, which minimizes the current buffer to, you know, to just to fit whatever it, you know, whatever it actually needs to have fit into it. That doesn't always work, obviously. I mean, if you've got a really, really tall buffer, it's not going to be able to do that for you, because it can't fit everything into a buffer, even, you know, no matter how much you want it to do that. But if you do have a fairly small buffer, then you can do that. Control X and then the plus symbol makes all of your buffers sort of even, more or less. I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're mixing vertical and horizontal splits, obviously the vertical split can't ever be equal to your horizontal split, because it's two different sizes. But that at least makes everything sort of nice and tidy if you've got a really crazy schema going and you decide, okay, it's time to kind of clean up. It's Control X and then the plus. Okay, so that's split screening in Emacs. Super simple, and powerful too. I use it all the time, really. I sometimes I'll have things split off to the side and then split again. It's great. I love it. It's especially good for those times where you're working on stuff where you actually need like references, you know, like something that you keep checking back on. I just keep that in like a little corner div, as it were, and just keep, you know, whenever I need the information, I'll just scroll down, look at it, and or do a search and find whatever I need. It's really handy. Okay, so I want to talk about MariaDB and do a little bit of a demo for MariaDB. MariaDB is by the same guy who did MySQL, and it is it's just a absolute simple MySQL replacement. It is drop-in replacement. There might be some edge cases where there's an exception. I have not heard of those myself, but then I haven't done a whole lot of research into it. But mostly it's basically MySQL with a new name. I find that MySQL tends to be pretty scary to people. It's so nebulous, you know. Where's the file? Where's the actual, like, where does that exist? It's kind of a scary idea, you know. I mean, it's like this database, and we're not clear on where it exists. Will we be able to get the data back out of that database later? How do we go about doing that? So it's not really that hard. So let's try to get familiar with it and see how we do. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. MySQL is a server. It runs or MariaDB for that matter. MySQL, MariaDB. Is a server, so it starts as a daemon, and on a lot of systems it may already be running in the background. So if I do a pgrep MySQL, I get 1203, and if I look at that that process number ps space 1203, I get not enough information on the screen because I have the text too large so that you can read it. So I'm going to do ps 1203 and pipe it through t, because I happen to know that that wraps the line. So I don't know if it's supposed to, but it does. So yeah, it looks like it's an Aconity process, which is KDE's like file indexing, the desktop indexer. So That's already running, but that's not actually the MySQL instance that we're going to interact with. So don't be deceived. If you see a MySQL thing running, it might just be something that belongs to another application. The way that we'll actually launch this thing is as a root user, so su and then into your root user, and then you do an /bin/mysqld_safe. And you want to do it that way because that's the safe way to do it. That way, if some other instance of MySQL is running, it won't clobber each other and take over each other's process IDs and stuff like that. So I hit return on that, and it gives me a little bit of a status. It tells me where it's logging stuff to and where its data directory is. The data directory by default, at least on my system, so it's out of the box, is var lib MySQL. So the next thing to do then is to log in, and specifically I want to log in as root for now. Now this is a clean install, and I didn't install it on Debian or anything like that, so this is a very clean install, meaning that this is out of the box. So it's kind of like a computer that I just bought from a store. There's no password on it, there's no users on it yet. Root exists, and there's no password to get in as root, you just do it. So that's obviously kind of dangerous. You don't really want to do that in real life, certainly not in production, I mean. I'm not going to set a root user for my MySQL database, because I'm afraid that if I do, I will forget it, because I very rarely use it, so I'm just going to leave it as is for now. But what I will do, just for good practice, is I'll create a user called Klaatu, and I'll set him to exist on localhost, and I'll tell it to that he's going to be identified with some password. And because this is a demo, I'll just do password 123. So at the mariadb/mysql prompt, all I'm doing is saying create user. It's convention to capitalize all the commands, all the MySQL commands. But honestly, you don't actually have to. It'll take it either way. But it's convention to capitalize them. So create user, and then quote Klaatu quote at quote localhost quote identified by quote password 123 close quote. Oop, and close the line, which is a semicolon. Okay, so now if I exit MySQL just with exit, then I should be able to do, for instance, MySQL -u Klaatu -p nothing. So MySQL -u Klaatu -p and then nothing. Now it's going to prompt me for my password 123, and now I'm in MySQL not as root anymore, which is nice. Okay, so that's easy. Let's do some simple commands. Oops. And actually, one thing that I failed to do, get back into root here. So MySQL -u -root. And I need to give permission to my user to do things. So I'm going to do a command called grant. And there's a series of permissions I can grant to Klaatu. So I'll do grant select, comma, create, comma, insert, comma, delete, comma, update on *.*. So that's all tables and all databases, to quote Klaatu close quote at quote localhost close quote semicolon. And now Klaatu, I believe we should find, has permission to actually get in there and muck around with databases. So the first thing we could do is just show databases. Show databases in this case tells us that we've got two databases, and one is called information_schema, and the other one is called test. Test is the thing that MySQL or MariaDB installed for us. An information schema, I believe, is the information about the users. I could be wrong on that. Don't quote me. But it's technical stuff that we don't care about as users. I've never actually looked at it. But test is, it's a test database that we got when we installed MySQL. Now, if I create a database, so I'll create database, and we'll call it GNU World Order, semicolon, then it says query is okay, one row affected. And now if you'll recall how we show databases, semicolon, now we've got something new. We've got information schema, we've got GNU World Order, we have MySQL, performance schema, and test. Obviously the one that we actually care about is GNU World Order, we as CLAT2. So we have a database now. That's exciting. That's how you create a database. So the next thing you might want to do, I mean, with any file, is, you know, you touch the file or you create the directory or whatever, and then you probably want to open it up and start messing around with it. So the open, like the open or you know, cd into foo of MySQL is use. That's the word use, use, use GNU World Order. And it says database has changed. And so now we have opened GNU World Order database for business, for reading and writing. Now if we do a show tables command, you see that we don't have any tables. So tables, the databases, I guess you could say it was the directory, and then the tables are the files inside of it, there's probably no good simile that will make any hardcore database admin happy. Point being, we don't have any. So we're gonna create a table. Create table episode semicolon. Actually, I don't want to do the semicolon yet. What we want to do is tell it what's gonna be in the table. So I press return and I get this little funky arrow sub prompt, and here I can define what kinds of information I want in this table called episode. So I guess you could think of this as the horizontal lines on a spreadsheet. So we'll call this one ID, and we'll make it an int or an integer. And furthermore, we're going to say that we have to have an ID, so that's not null. So it's ID space int space not space null. And then, even more so, we're going to tell it that we want to use this as our primary key. And it would be quite nice if it would auto-increment our primary key for us. So that is now ID space int space not space null space auto underscore increment space primary space key. And that's it for that line. So we're going to end that line with a comma. You can kind of think of it almost, I think of it as sort of like JSON, you know, like you're still in the parentheses, so you kind of have to keep this going. So we'll say int, or the ID is that one, and then we'll do a title field as well, and that's going to be text. So that'll be title space text, comma. And then we'll go ahead and give it a number as well, and we can say that that's going to be an int as well, and it's not going to be null. We have to give it a number, and we'll say that that's not null, so then I'll close the parentheses on that, because that's all we want in our little table. And I'm going to go so far as to say that it's going to be the default character set is going to be UTF-8. So that's close parentheses, or so this line is num space int, not null, all spaces, close parentheses, and then default character set, all capitals, and then in lowercase UTF-8. And then semicolon, because we're done. Okay, so now it's telling us that we've finished that command successfully. It says zero rows have been affected, but if we do a show tables, we see now that we've got our database, and now we've got a new little table, really, called tables underscore in underscore GNU World Order, and the thing that exists in that is episode. So let's see what happens if we start putting more information in here. We've got a new tables, really. We've got a new table called tables underscore in underscore GNU World Order, and the thing in there is called episode. So that's the episode table, right? So now if we say, well, describe episode for us, MySQL. So describe episode semicolon, and now it gives us a fancy looking table with all the different field types. This is where it starts to get exciting. So you've got the field called ID. The type of that is integer. By default, you have an 11 digits in that. Can it be null? No. Is it a key, the primary key? Yes. It is a key, and the type is primary key. The default is null, and the extra information about it is auto-increment. Title is text, null, it can be null, it's not a key, default is null, and there's no extra. And then num is an integer, it cannot be null, it's not a key, the default is null, and no extra information. So that's kind of our world view right now in our file. So the things that you, I guess, probably want to remember to look around is show databases and describe tables, or describe a table name. Or, well, come to think of it, you can also describe, or you can show tables as well. So show and describe are two very useful things. So now let's try putting some data into all of this stuff. The command for that is insert, which makes sense. There are fields we want to input data or insert data. So it's insert is the name of the let me get that to the top of the screen. So insert is the command. So we insert into episode. Is it episodes or episode? Darn it, I shouldn't have cleared the screen. Show tables. Episode. Good for me. Insert into episode. And then we'll open a parenthesis. We know that there's the ID, right? But ID is auto-incremented. We don't need to do that. So we need a show title, and we need a show num. So we do parentheses title comma num in UM, close parentheses. And without closing that, so no semicolon. So without closing that, I hit return, and that way I can continue this command. And I will do a specify the values. So I've just given it kind of like what I want to insert into, and then I need to specify what values I want to put into those things. And that's pretty simple. You could probably even guess it. It's the word values, which you probably wouldn't have guessed, but you could have. And then in the same exact order, we do parentheses, and then in quotes we'll say let's name this MariaDB demo, and then comma, and then quote 09, because this is episode 09, and then we can close the parentheses. That's the command, so we'll do a semicolon to end the command, and now it tells us that, okay, one row is affected. And now to see into those, you would think it would be show, and that used to really trip me up, but it's actually select. Because this is where the SQL comes in. You're selecting data from all of these tables. So the key word here is select. And we could say select, for instance, the num value, num, from, capital from, and then whatever episode, from episode table, rather, where, that's the capital W-H-E-R-E, and then we'll say title is like, and then we'll use the MySQL wildcard syntax, and we'll do demo, because we called it demo, I believe, or we called it MariaDB demo. So the full command here, select num from episode where title like percent demo percent semicolon. Oops, sorry, my bad. That was an error, and I forgot to do the quotes around the demo. Okay, so remembering to do the quotes around percent demo percent, we get back one little result, and that is the num value of 9. Because in my database, where there's a keyword we're grepping essentially for demo, it's going to spit out the results of the number of the num field. Now we could also do, for instance, we could actually just say select star from episode where title like demo, and then that gives us the whole table. So ID is 1, that was auto incremented for us, and then the title is MariaDB demo, and then the show number is 9. Or we could even just say select star from episode, and it would give us all the tables from episode, all 1 of them. Okay, so we could insert more data, right? So insert into episode title num, the values, let's do, what are we covering next episode? I don't know. We'll call it foo and bar, comma 10. And then we'll do one more, show 11, where we will be covering Unix is better than most. Okay, so now if we do a select all or a select star from episode semicolon, then we have 3 little rows in our table. IDs are auto incrementing 1, 2, 3. Titles are MariaDB, demo, foo, and bar. Unix is better than most. And the episode numbers of each of those is 9, 10, and 11. Pretty cool. And again, you can do all kinds of fancy selections. I mean, that's kind of the point, right? So if you wanted to see all of the episodes that mention Unix, then you could do a select all from episode where title like quote percent Unix percent quote, and that would show you all 1 title that mentions Unix. And so on. I mean, and you don't have to search, obviously, against the title. You could search against, I don't know, the num. And that would show you all of the, if you do select all from episode where num like, quote, 1%, quote, semicolon, then that shows you all of the episodes that are, you know, 1 and then some number. So that's a very brief introduction into SQL. That's about all I know about it, to be honest. Now, if you'll recall the permission command that we used earlier to grant Klaatu some permissions, we did another thing, which was update. Now, update is how we've written everything to this file. Update is how we can change things. So we'll look at our table set again, and you know, we don't really mention Unix a whole lot, and that's a pity. So what we'll do is we'll update, and we'll set the title to Unix and Linux, where the ID is, let's go with 1. So the full command there is update, that's the keyword to change data, update, and then episode, that is of course the table that we're working with. I accidentally hit return, but that's okay. And then we set the title to equals, so set title equals, quote, Unix and Linux, where ID equals, quote, 1, quote, semicolon. So update episode, set title equals, quote, Unix and Linux, quote, where ID equals, quote, 1, quote, semicolon. And now if we select all from the episode, we should see that, oh, I did that wrong. I renamed today's show Unix and Linux. That's okay. We can change that. So we can update the episode, set title to Unix and Linux, where ID equals 2. And then we could go back to where it says 1 and go back to MariaDB. And now if we show the thing, we've got it correct. So we've got MariaDB select all from the episode, ID 1 MariaDB, and then Unix and Linux, and then Unix is better than most, meaning that we should be able to then say select all from episode where title like quote percent. Actually, we could even start with this. We could just say we know that Unix is the first word, and then there's some kind of thing after it, and then a semicolon, and sure enough, we get the last two shows shown, Unix and Linux. Unix is better than most, so that's episodes 10 and 11 again. And that, my friends, is your very, very simple introduction to MySQL. Obviously, there's a lot more, and once you know what we just did, then you can start scripting those things with other languages, and that's kind of how you would leverage MariaDB with something like Python or PHP or whatever. So that's just an intro, but now you hopefully feel a little bit more comfortable with it. And it's a great thing to know, or at least, you know, do it once. And then when you're, you know, inevitably migrating your WordPress blog or your Drupal install or whatever, you can do that yourself. You can do you can do all of those commands and understand what you're doing. It's good to know. So have a go at that. And let's also have a go at getting some coffee, because it's about that time. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about file managers for the noobs. And we'll do some compiling of code for everyone else. Alright, I'm ready. I've got coffee. Took a few sips. I'll take some more. But not now. First, we'll do some discussion over all the different file managers that you could possibly use on Linux. This is one of those things that, I don't know, you could look at it both ways. You know, you could be the naysayer and say, oh my gosh, too much choice. Or you could be like me, and probably, I feel like most other Linux users, just utter total excitement over the amount of choice you have, because my gosh, one of the first things, probably one of the first, you know, problems that I had with my old OS before I found Linux, a long time ago now, was that there was only one way to access sort of like what I thought was my computer, you know, like the computer, which is what Linux users think everything is, you know, it's the computer. My files, where are my files? They're on the computer. There's only one way to look at those things. And when I found out just simple commands like ls and found out that I could look at files with an ls, I mean, that was really powerful stuff. That was exciting, you know? And then finding out that, oh my gosh, I can do a copy of this one file, and it'll copy that file to a new name, and it even, right after I do it, it appears on my desktop. It what I just did appears right there. So I'm seeing the same data, but in a different way. Well, it turns out that you can see the data in different ways too, and it doesn't have to be through the terminal. You can have other windows into your file system, and it doesn't have to just be whatever came on your Linux distribution. I'm assuming you're starting out with Slackware. Why wouldn't you be? And so the default on your system would probably be either Dolphin or Conqueror. And there are so many more options. So let's take a look at, like, all of them. So here's all the file managers that I happen to have installed on this computer. That's not by any means a complete list of all the file managers available on Linux. So the first one I'm going to show is Dolphin. That's kind of the default of the KDE desktop. The other one, the other sort of the old default for KDE is called Conqueror, which at first glance is pretty similar, maybe, but it's actually quite different and something that I don't actually know a whole lot about because I started using KDE seriously after Dolphin had come around. Yet another one is Thunar, which is the default for the XFCE desktop, so that's another default one. And then we'll talk a little bit about PCMan FM, which I believe might be the default on the LXDE desktop. Not 100% sure about that, because I don't really use that much. And then yet another one is Space FM, which I don't think is the default on anything. It's just kind of an extra one that happens to exist. And then last but not least, and in fact the one that I'm not really going to talk about at all, is called MC, Midnight Commander, I think. And this seems to be a favorite among certain people. Not me. I've never used anything like this before, so I can't even really talk about it. But some people seem to really, really like this. And it just kind of... I think it has something to do with if you grew up on DOS. This seems to be pretty popular with people who knew it from that. And it's purely, as you can see, sort of within the terminal. I literally don't even know how to navigate this thing. I know up and down arrows, and that's the best I can do. So we'll just hit F10 to get out of this. Just wanted to mention it because it does exist, and some people absolutely love it and find it very comfortable and familiar. I do not. I've never used anything like that. Don't really care about it. Okay, so let's just talk really quickly basic functionality. That wasn't one. Basic functionality is pretty much, you know, the same. I mean, you right-click and you can find all kinds of basic file management types of options. That's fairly universal, I think. I don't think that you'll find a whole lot of file managers out there that do this, you know, drastically different. Like, oh my gosh, a right-click doesn't give you logical answer possibilities. And usually there's some kind of either menu bar or button bar or both, depending on which one you're using and what kind of preferences you have turned on. And they do things like navigate and go to different places and so on. So that's, again, pretty standard across the board. Not all that surprising. Of course, in all cases, preferences is probably your friend in terms of getting the thing to work exactly the way that you want it to. Thunar, it's edit preferences. Space FM, it's view preferences. PCMan FM is edit preferences. And then both Conqueror and Dolphin have it in the settings menu under configure Dolphin or configure Conqueror. And, you know, Conqueror is kind of famous, maybe infamous sometimes, for having a lot of options, like just options upon options, really. It's pretty phenomenal. You can do, you can tweak it so that it doesn't even look recognizable anymore. And in fact, even my Dolphin probably doesn't look super recognizable to a lot of people. Actually, this version does. I usually, on my laptop, my old laptop, I used to not have the sidebar on it, the side panel, and nothing at the top. It was a very sort of minimal kind of, just here's a graphical view of the files, and I would navigate with keyboard stuff. So, and Dolphin has, and Conqueror 2, I think, has, settings for previews, but really cool kind of extra things, which I cannot find because I'm looking for it right now. But, yeah, there's things like Git integration and stuff like that, which is kind of nice. So those are kind of the basic, obvious things. Another sort of, now I think it's basically expected, is the side panel off on the left. All of them typically either have that turned on by default or have it as an option. Dolphin, I think, has it by default, but you can tell it, don't show the places menu, and then you don't have that anymore, and that might be something that you like. I don't know how to do that on Thunar. Probably, like, compact something, or in preferences, or just telling it to turn off the side pane, That works. There's also that option in Space FM and PC Man FM, but it kind of depends on. Well, it's actually quite configurable. You can tell it what to show or what not to show on the side panel, and that's kind of nice because you can view or not view partition tables. You can view, you can turn off viewing empty drives or internal drives, all kinds of cool things. So that's usually either in the menus or it's in preferences if you can't find it in the menus. So there you go. That's side panel. Pretty standard stuff. Another more or less standard within Linux is that the location, like the URL or the URI of where you are is usually editable. Again, usually by default. I have it turned on all of these, even when it doesn't look like it, like on Dolphin. It is turned on all of them. You just kind of have to possibly tell it to let you edit it, like in Dolphin, but you could have that on by default as well. Sometimes I do on this install. For whatever reason, I don't. So one of the things that's useful for, because you might think, well, if I'm going to type in a location, like, why am I using a graphical file manager? But the thing about that is, like, if you're kind of working in both a terminal and a graphical file manager, let's say, and you decide, oh, this looks like a really good folder, but I really kind of want to see this. I want to see this graphically. Then you can copy the path from one place, paste that into the location bar, and it will take you straight there. And then you can see it graphically, which maybe you want, because maybe you wanted to see the thumbnails or something like that. So that's kind of nice. Another thing that some of them have, possibly all of them, doesn't look like it, a lot of them will have a specialized view for instance, applications. Now this I like a lot, because I'm far more used to this view of applications than I am to a menu-based view. The menu view I don't really much care for. I'd rather just see icons that I could then search for and launch depending on what I want to launch. That seems more logical to me than a menu with a bunch of subcategories that I never know where anything is located. That's kind of annoying. So some of them have that available, some of them probably don't, I don't know. But I think I've found that on most of them. Certainly the ones that I use a lot, I've got that turned on. It should be in Space FM as well. I'm not really remembering where that is right now. But I'm pretty sure that exists on there. Or maybe it's PC FM that I'm thinking of with the applications. That's pretty obviously right there. So yeah, that's something that you may or may not like, depending on how you like to look at applications. And of course, ultimately, which one you use, it just kind of depends on your own kind of preference and what you fall into and what you end up preferring after a little bit of use. So I would encourage you to probably use these a little bit to kind of get a feel for different ones, not just the one that came with your system. Try out a different one. If you feel like something could be better, try a different one and see what you think, because a lot of times you'll find something a little bit nice about one that kind of then sells you on that for a long time. PC Man FM, for instance, let's say I was in a folder full of things and I knew that I wanted to select everything except one of them. So what you can do is select the one that you don't want to select and then edit invert selection, and it does that. It inverts the selection, so it selects everything but the one that you didn't want to select, and then you could do whatever you wanted to do with them. I don't know. So that's like one of my favorite features of PC Man FM. Space FM has well, the really fine grained left panel, which I really like. I like that a lot. It's also got some really nice views of kind of a split screen view somewhere. There we go. So you can have like one window with essentially, you know, two different windows in it, which kind of doubles up if you think about it. It's kind of like, well, isn't that why we have tabs? But in a sense, no, it's not. It is unique from that, because if, sure, you can have different tabs, but then you don't get to see them at the same time. So you can kind of see two different folders at the same time with that, which is kind of nice. Yeah, so that's a nice feature of that. And then Thunar, I don't know, there's a bulk renamer or something somewhere around here. I think it's a separate executable, but it's probably in here somewhere. People seem to like that a lot. You can select and rename things in bulk, which I usually do, honestly, in a shell script. That's why I don't actually use it, but I have heard a lot of people kind of praise it because of that function. Like, that's the killer feature of that. And I don't know what the killer feature of Dolphin would be. Maybe, as I said, like the Git integration. So if I've got a Git, if I've got a Git folder, a folder that has Git in it, I don't know how to show the hidden files. But anyway, there's a .git folder in here, and that's what these little icons on each the little badges, I should say, on each icon represents, whether it's been synchronized with my Git repository yet. And you can see that I can even do commands like git remove, or I could git add, or I could do a git pull or a git push, all from within Dolphin, which really is kind of a killer feature. It's pretty amazing that that's just like right there in the file manager.
So that's a lot of choice. Don't be overwhelmed. Don't be afraid. It's not a bad thing. You don't have to feel pressured. You don't have to feel like this is too much. Take your pick, or just use what they gave you. It doesn't matter. Just know that there are a lot of different choices out there. And you know, what you might want to do is try a different one like every week or something, or every 2 weeks, until you find something that you really, really love. Honestly, for me, the way that I sort of developed in my file system choices, or in my file manager choices rather, was that on a low spec kind of like hacked together version of an X desktop that I had very early on, it was like Roxfiler, I think, was the one file manager that would compile and that I could use, so I used it, you know. That was the choice being made for me. And then later, when I found out that there are others on Linux proper, that was great, and I kind of fell into using whatever shipped. But then I found out, you know, that there were others available, and so I would just kind of play around with them. And you know, eventually you just kind of you work out which one is the best for you. And so in practice, at this point, Dolphin is what I typically use on a system, but if it's a low-spec system, I'll usually default to, like, Roxfiler or Thunar. But Roxfiler is the one I'm, I guess, a little bit more familiar with, just because I got introduced to it fairly early on, just, you know, by chance, really. Okay, so no more noob stuff. Now we're talking to everyone else, noobs included. I mean, don't go away, noobs. We're all noobs, so we should all stay and listen to this thing, which is a little bit advanced, but it's interesting nevertheless. It's about cross-compiling. So these days, we've got the legacy 32-bit computers. I don't know why I just looked at the screen. It's not 32-bit. I'm pretending like that's 32-bit. And then we've got 64-bit. And a lot of the systems out there come as they are delivered to you, they are multi-lib, meaning they have both 32-bit libraries and 64-bit libraries. And no, I can't explain to you the difference between 32-bit and 64-bit. because I don't really understand it myself. All I know is it's got to do with longer numbers and stuff like that. Point being, though, if you're on 64-bit, in theory, you can run 32-bit things, as long as you've got 32-bit libraries. Makes sense. If you're on 32-bit, you're not going to be able to run a 64-bit version of anything, because your CPU can only do 32 bits. So assuming that you're running 64-bit, but you want to compile something for 32-bit, then that's a cross-compile. And in order to do that, you need to have, as I said, the 32-bit libraries on your system. So let's take a look at compiling, first of all, and then LDD, and then how to get things to look exclusively at 32-bit libraries while it's doing the install.
Okay, so to compile, first of all, we need some code, which happily I've set some aside. So this is, we'll just take a look at this really quick. It's a really basic little C++ application. No outlandish dependencies. It's all standard stuff. And it's just a little dice game. So it's not terribly complex. The computer picks a number, you pick a number, and you see who wins based on who rolls the highest number, I guess. Okay, so to do that normally, it would be GCC, but in this case it's G++ because it's C++. And then we'll do out, and we'll call it dice64.bin. And that should work, and it did. And now if I should have probably done that before, so you can see that we are indeed on a 64-bit system. So that's good. And now if I launch my executable here, it seems to work more or less. So there you go. And then we can see what kind of file this is with file dice64.bin, and that tells us that it's an ELF 64-bit LSB executable. So that's a Linux executable x86-64, meaning it's a 64-bit application. So that worked. That's kind of what we expected. And then if we just curious as to the sizes. 590, let's do this. 590 bytes for the source code, and 12,270 bytes for the executable. It's always interesting to look at that sort of stuff. But anyway, it's not important. So what we'll do at this point, just to see what exactly we're dealing with, is LDD dice64.bin. LDD is it's sort of the reverse of LD. It's the analytical tool to see what libraries an executable kind of expect to find. That this library is linked to the lib standard C++, and what version that is, and where that's located physically on the system, as well as its address on a lower level. Libm, libgcc, libc, and that's pretty much it, I guess, really, that we need to worry about. So that's just kind of for you to see, I guess, why it's a 64-bit library, like what makes it a 64-bit application. So the next thing that we can try is to make a 32-bit executable version of this, and for that you need a 32-bit stack, a development stack. If you don't have that, then this will not work. And I have this by way of Alien Bob, who does a lot of multi-lib stuff. So I'm on Slackware, and that's kind of all this multi-lib stuff from a user named Alien Bob does a lot of this stuff. Not have Slackware on your system, you probably should. Basically just doing a yum search or a dnf search version of C GCC, and it's usually what's involved. So assuming that you have that in place, you have to tell it that you want to run G++. You want to use 32-bit architecture. We will tell it what we want to compile first, so that's the DICE CPP, and we might as well go ahead and tell it the output right now while we're thinking about it. So we'll say DICE32.bin. The .bin, by the way, is just arbitrary. I could call it, I could call it nothing. I could call it, what's the other one that I'm thinking of? Run? I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to call it .bin because I can. You can, really, it doesn't matter. You can call it whatever you want. DICE32.bin, and then we need to tell it what library, what to look for when I tell it to go to the libraries, because by default, of course, it's going to look at lib64, because its architecture is 64. You can call it whatever you want. DICE32.bin, and then we need to tell it what library, what to look for when I tell it to go to the libraries, because by default, of course, it's going to look at lib64. So I'm going to just tell it to look in /user/lib. And then I'm also going to tell it that the architecture that I want it to build for or to optimize for is the architecture of, I'm going to go for 586. So now if I do a file and I look at the 32-bit thing that we've just built, you can see that it is indeed an ELF file, 32-bit LSB, dynamically linked. So if it's dynamically linked, that means we should be able to see what it is linked to with DICE32.bin. And as you can see, we've got the same set of libraries, lib, standard, C++, .so.6, but instead of pointing to the one in lib64, it's pointing to the one at /usr/lib/lib standard C++, blah, blah, blah. Same goes for libm, libgcc, and libc. So the full command there, in case you're not watching the video, is G++ space -m32, and then the source code, dice.cpp in this case, and then the output, -o, dice, in this case, dice32, and we'll call it run, and then -L /usr/lib, and then -march equals i586. And that command gets you, it sets the fact that you're using 32-bit, where to look when it's looking for libraries, and then what kind of optimizations for what architecture specifically we're using. So, I mean, i586 is obviously a 32-bit architecture, but it's as opposed to, for instance, i486 or i686, which we could probably do, to be fair. Will this 32-bit application run on this 64-bit computer? And of course it does, and that's only because I have the multilib libraries. So I've got a bunch of stuff in /usr/lib, and that's why this is running, because it can find all the libraries that it needs in order to run.
So that's the basics. Understand that this was a pretty simple example, so if your app is a lot more complex and it's producing more than just a single binary when you're compiling, then you need to tell GCC what to call each file, you know, each of those objects that you're creating, and where to save them. So that's something to keep in mind. And also, if the app uses a make file that you did not create yourself, then or that you did but now you want to change it, then you would want to add all that stuff to the make file, rather than just doing it directly through GCC, because you know, the makefile would have a lot more information on what it needs to compile in order to complete different things. So that's just something to keep in mind. I mean, like I say, this was just an example to get you started with the concept of cross-compiling, and if you actually really, really need to cross-compile something in real life, I assume you'd do a little bit of research on how to do that. But now you've gotten a head start. This is the basics. if you need the specifics, take a look at what you're trying to compile and add to whatever I've just shown you with stuff that would apply directly to your project. That's about it for this episode. I don't think I have any more to say. So thank you for watching or listening, and I will talk to you next time.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at Klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation, .org. And you can also find me on LinuxQuestions.org as not Klaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
So get lost, Willie. You're acting mighty silly.